This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Logan Marshall Green gives his acting career an upgrade while Johnny Knoxville bottoms out with Action Point.
But before we go anywhere near Action Point, we're going to start with Lee Whannell's upgrade. Lee Whannell being the Saw scribe and most recently director of Insidious 3. And this is backed by Blumhouse as well. And I am happy to report that this is pretty much in line with Happy Death Day in terms of quality. I mentioned before in this podcast that I feel like the Blumhouse brand is just going stronger than ever. And they're taking a lot of fun risks and they're investing in filmmakers and in making them be creative with their products. And I think that quality really shows. I mean, we didn't get to Truth or Dare earlier this year. I heard that was kind of crappy, but that's neither here nor there because for the most part, I think their output has been very strong. And Upgrade follows suit. It's basically about this guy who he and his wife are mugged. They're an affluent couple. They're mugged in the inner city. She is murdered and he is left as a quadriplegic. Yada, yada, yada. There's some weirdo billionaire Asperger genius who wants to implant a computer chip in the back of his neck to not only make him walk again, but to increase his overall brain power. And this thing actually turns into kind of like some type of like Big Brother, all right, so I guess the best comparison would be Venom, and that's, you know, partly because Green kind of looks like Tom Hardy a little bit, but also it has that same premise of, you know, the voice in the back of your head. You don't necessarily have control over your own body at all times. And this is a really effective, fun movie. I mean, there are some pretty brutal kills in it, which I wouldn't, you know, obviously I'm not expecting anything less depending on this guy. And I know I'm poo-poo on violence in general, but it's just fun in this. This reminds me of the action movies and the sci-fi movies that I used to see back in the 90s that my dad let me watch for some reason. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a really intriguing premise. There are a lot of fun visual cues with the camera work. And they really just, there's like a beautiful stylistic cinematography to it with you know, the really interesting colors, uses of reds and greens that are like flashing through windows and blues, and the production design is really interesting as well in that this is clearly set maybe, you know, 20-30 years down the road, but it still feels grounded in what would be reality. This isn't like, you know, some Back to the Future-esque portrayal of the future. That actually makes it a little bit more chilling. And you know, for the most part, I was wondering, you know, I heard this was a little bit of a horror movie, and the idea of, you know, this AI coming to life and influencing, coming to life through a human puppet, if you will, and influencing that human puppet is really the scariest part of it. But this is, you know, this is really inventive and clever sci-fi that's really entertaining. And it's hard because I don't want to get into spoilers. I actually didn't even see the trailer before I saw this movie, which I'll do from time to time just because if I see a movie's getting good reviews, whatever, I'll wait it out. But this is really just a blast from beginning to end. It's pulpy, it's fun, it's funny, and the fact that they can actually make some of these hyper-violent scenes amusing in some way is the highest credit that I can pay a film of this ilk.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key to any really good, you know, genre film is to sort of put, you know, your own sort of twist on a concept that's been known previously. And that's exactly what Whannell does here. And just sort of going back to sort of some of his earlier career, obviously, as you mentioned, he was known for writing, he had the first Saw, I think the first three Saw movies. And it's safe to say, I don't think the scripts were exactly the strength of those films. But he went on to write one of my favorite sort of Halloween type movies in the first Insidious, and then went on to write the other two, and as you mentioned, directed Insidious Chapter 3. And although I didn't see that, I did hear from some people that he showed off some really visually distinctive style, and that's clearly on display here in Upgrade. You mentioned the cinematography and the action sequences. I thought it was really, really fun the way they did it with the camera just sort of glides along with him and his act, and sort of when the artificial intelligence takes over his body, the camera sort of reflects that through its movements, and I thought that was a really clever way to do it, and it was just a lot of fun to see that. But you know, I think the best element of this film without question is the relationship between Logan Marshall Green's Gray and the artificial intelligence known as STEM here. And you could almost say, and it's fitting because we're going to be seeing this film in 70mm coming up here, but it's almost like an alternate version of if Hal, you know, was inside your body and was like making you do things, and that's sort of how it's played out, where where, like, at certain times, you know, Gray, Logan Marshall Green's character, has control, and then other times, you know, Stem takes over, particularly in the action sequences, and it leads to those, you know, incredible violence that you had mentioned here. But, you know, I have to say, I was impressed with the lead performance from Logan Marshall Green, an actor who, you know, who's been in a bunch of stuff, but he's usually always that other guy. He was in Prometheus. He's sort of always, like, playing second or third fiddle, although I'll always hold a special place in my heart for him for playing the infamous Trey Atwood on the OC. And those of you who know, and I don't even have to say, but, you know, this doesn't count as a spoiler because it's been so many years back, but his death scene in the OC is, safe to say, a classic that will never be able to live down, but that I enjoyed thoroughly. I just thought he seemed like he was having fun, like, just, like, you know, in the actions, he could just playing, as I said, playing off the artificial intelligence, and also just, you know, I mean, it wasn't, like, sort of terrible quippy one-liners, you know, at least, you know, when he gets into the action, so it felt like he was feeling the confidence and felt like he was having fun, and sometimes that's the key to, you know, enjoying a film. You know, and as I mentioned about Lee Whannell previously, you know, a lot of times he's been criticized in the past for his scripts having some wonky dialogue, and there is that, particularly early on in the film with some of the interactions between Logan Marshall Green and his girlfriend. There's some dialogue lines that would have been best, you know, removed. But, you know, that's definitely something I can relate to as a writer. Dialogue is not as easy as it seems in some cases, especially in genre films where dialogue doesn't necessarily have to be that great, but as I said, the film overcomes it in no time, just with the fun premise, you know, the fun sort of antagonistic figures. Just some weird stuff in this movie, you know, sci-fi stuff that you haven't really quite seen in this way in the film, and that's something I appreciated. It's definitely sort of a cautionary tale of technology, and, you know, we've talked about in the past how, you know, although this isn't a straight-up horror film, the best horror films, you know, take on elements of society and, you know, give social commentary, as do sci-fi films, and this film is definitely the case with that.
Exactly, and I think the biggest compliment that I can pay to this film is that so it's a sci-fi action thriller, you know, whodunit chase film for the most part, and then towards the end it starts, like, taking a creepier turn, and it just, like, does it very subtly at first. And it really just builds up to an ending that really caught me off guard, and I was very impressed by it. I mean, it's one of those things where they set it up, and it obviously looks like it's going to go one way, but it really, maybe I just wasn't paying that much attention, but it blindsided me. I thought that was really clever the way they paid that off, and it elevated it from, you know, just this fun genre piece, which, and the fight scenes are incredible. I mean, the way that camera moves, you mentioned it's like when Spike Lee does those tracking shots, and, like, the camera moves with the body, but it really just has, like, this disquieting feel is this ending kind of washes over you, and it really, like, the movie ends and you're like, oh my god, and I can't really say anything more than that, but it really does hammer home that idea of, you know, artificial intelligence, the cautionary tale surrounding that, and to say anything else would be to give anything else, be to give things away. And I guess the one negative I want to spell out, unfortunately, is that Betty Gabriel is pretty wasted in this film. I thought that she was actually Oscar worthy in Get Out, just, like, from her, whatever it was, 15 minutes that she was in that as the transformed maid, if you will. In this film, she just plays, you know, generic cop chase number one, and you know, that plays out pretty much how you'd think. But everything just, like, ties together really well, and the fact that I was having so much fun, and then just all of a sudden it made me feel really uncomfortable at the very end is really just a huge credit to it. And again, I gotta give a lot of credit to Blumhouse. I know they have whatever it is, the webcam movie coming out again, the second one that takes place on the dark web. Ooh, we'll get to that another time. But yeah, overall, this is a blast. This is the kind of movie you go into in the middle of the summer, not really having too many expectations for, even if you expect to have fun, and you come out thoroughly entertained.
Yeah, totally. I completely agree with you there, and I agree on the ending as well, where a film like this could have easily, you know, sometimes genre films are ruined by their ending, and I think this film succeeds with its ending. You know, it's not really a cop-out ending. It ends the way it feels like a story, like this should. But you mentioned Blumhouse and these, you know, computer films. Well, get ready, because there's more, because I saw another different trailer for a movie similar to that yesterday, starring John Cho of Harold and Kumar fame. So I can't even imagine what that's going to be. But apparently this is a new horror subgenre we're going to have to deal with. But I think, you know, both of us clearly recommend Upgrade, and we can turn our attention to some news this week. I mean, there was pretty much an overabundance of trailers. Anyone who's online this week could could see that. But we're going to focus on two in particular, staying in the genre realm. And the first we're going to talk about is the trailer for Luca Guadagnino's remake, or as we could tell from the trailer, more of a reimagining of Suspiria, one of my absolute favorite films, the original directed by Dario Argento in his giallo phase, although Suspiria doesn't have all the qualities that other giallos do. It's a really interesting film and more just really about atmosphere, and has one of the greatest scores of all time. Might be my favorite score. It's hard to say exactly, but this trailer really got me excited because it's not this remake that's trying to just tell the same story in a contemporary side, and I knew that wasn't what Luca was going to do because he's clearly an artist. For those of you who remember, you know, our thoughts on Call Me By Your Name, this is the director of that film. But the trailer was played, it was just perfect. It was like the score from Tom York sounded incredible. And obviously, as I said, you know, the original having the greatest score of all time, it's great. I mean, obviously, you expect nothing less from someone like Tom York. Hopefully, he's going to follow in Greenwood's footsteps and have a lot of great classic scores. But just the use of the visuals, just the creepy tone to it. Tilda Swinton is the perfect person to be in this movie. That's the first part. When I saw she was in the cast, I was like, oh my god, that is the perfect choice for sort of any of you know the original sort of, you know, there's a witch element to this that is going to be interesting. But just the way the trailer throws unique visuals, really stunning cinematography, just the way it ends, I was just like, oh man, this is the most pumped I've been for, you know, a horror film in this realm in quite some time.
Oh, totally. And I, you know, it was funny when this news first broke. It was actually before we had actually seen Call Me By Your Name. And, you know, I profess that I unfortunately did not get to see, Bigger Splash or any of Guadagnino's earlier efforts. And, you know, even after seeing Call Me By Your Name, it really was intriguing to me that he was going to be taking on this particular, not just genre, but this particular property in general. And I think that that European art house sensibility that he has is really on display here. And, you know, I kind of feel ashamed for having ever doubted him in the first place. This looks incredible. Obviously, I've said ad nauseum on this podcast before, Radiohead is my favorite band of all time, so I'm well on board with Tom York doing the score. But, this is something that I was surprised was going to be good. Looks like it's not going to just be good, but incredibly good. And considering the source material, that's high praise indeed. And speaking of horror trailers, we also had David Gordon Green's teaser trailer for the Halloween sequel, the direct sequel to the first film, which I am super pumped about. Halloween is my favorite classic horror film of all time. I will watch that at least twice every October. That might not seem a lot, but I don't really have a lot of brain power to divulge anymore. So that's pretty impressive that I can watch that movie in that kind of succession every year. I mentioned when I first saw the trailer to Andrew that this is the Halloween movie that we need. This is just going back to the roots of the series, like the Boogeyman in the Closet type stuff, and it looks like it's going to be fun. And that's, you know, I hate to always, you know, hammer home this point, but, you know, after October we get into the dregs of award season, for better or worse, and those movies can just drain you in a completely different way. So I appreciate the fact that we're going to have a blast in the theater. It's going to be fun, and they're making Michael Myers scary again, and that's something I didn't think was going to be possible.
And obviously, from our most anticipated of the year list, obviously you could tell this one was anticipated of the year. And I will say the trailer, I thought it was solid. I wasn't blown away by it, and how could I be after the Suspiria trailer? It's a completely different thing, but I'm definitely pumped for it. It has unique, as you said, it's sort of going back to the basics, and I could tell that just from reading interviews with David Gordon Green and, yes, comedic actor Danny McBride, who co-wrote this film with Green, which is a really interesting tidbit to this film. But I just loved how Jamie Lee Curtis looked as Laurie Strode. They're clearly, as you could see from the trailer, they're going away from her being Michael Myers' sibling, which I think was, you know, not a very great decision in the first place. I mean, it just sort of, you know, it's one of those, you know, we talked about genre twists where at the end of a movie can be ruined. You know, sometimes genre films and horror films can just throw a twist in there just to make it feel more connected, and sometimes it doesn't make it more impactful. And as you mentioned, it's great that they're going back to the basics, and, you know, this is the boogeyman, and, you know, in my intro to film class that I teach every semester, I show the original Halloween, so obviously it's one of my, you know, favorite films as well, and I'm really interested to see sort of how, you know, it's going to be interesting showing the film in my class and then seeing the new one, you know, right around that time. So it's going to be a really fun experience. But, you know, there's a bunch of other trailers that you could check out this week. Steve McQueen's Widows, among others, Bradley Cooper's A Star Is Born, etc. There's so many, too many trailers to count this week. It was just sort of the onslaught. But these are the two we chose to focus on as being two that we're really, really pumped for later in the year. But with that in mind, unfortunately, we have to transition into our second film of the day, which honestly, I can honestly say is easily a contender for worst film of the year, if you could even call it a film or a movie, because it barely qualifies. And we're talking about Action Point, starring the one and only Johnny Knoxville. Now, me and you, I remember we went to a screening of Jackass 3D, and it was a lot of fun. And I think we're both fans of, you know, I think it's fun, you know, stupid Jackass stuff and stunts. Well, this film promises more than it could possibly deliver, because if you saw the trailer, you saw the only possible things you could connect to in this film, because there's nothing else to this movie. It is literally just, obviously we're you know, big into art house and stuff like that, so this is certainly not a case of us thumbing our noses up at Johnny Knoxville. As we said, we've appreciated the Jackass stuff before, but this film is terrible, god-awful. I'll be honest, I went around Tomatoes, and I couldn't believe that there were critics that actually gave this a positive review. I don't know what you are watching, people, but you need to rethink. Like, I understand how you turn your brain off in this. This is not one of those films where you can just turn your brain off and enjoy it. The trailer promises real stunts. The only stunts you see are the ones from the trailer. There is nothing else to it. The plot of this film, if you can even call it a plot, sort of centers on this relationship between Johnny Knoxville, who runs this park, you know, and his daughter, who is a strange daughter. Oh man, I haven't seen this before in a movie. A great cliche. And throughout the movie, the only thing, she's like, "Oh, I want to see the Clash." And then, speaking of which, we're not gonna hesitate to spoil this movie, because it's impossible to spoil this turd. So she wants to go see the Clash, and then, oh, wouldn't you know it, Johnny Knoxville, the financial strain of the park is taking too much of a toll on him, so he forgets to take her to see the Clash. What a plot point. What a dramatic moment. I mean, I actually like Johnny Knoxville. You know, I think he's, you know, an interesting guy. I think the fact that he hasn't died yet is truly incredible based on the things he's done. And I don't know if you heard about this, but in this film, there's that stunt where he gets projected into the barn. And apparently, he injured his penis in this. So, I mean, I'm questioning whether, you know, that was the last thing they filmed. And, like, he hurt his penis. And, like, all right, you know what? We're not going to do anything else for this movie. Because that's what it feels like. There is nothing to this movie. There's nothing for the audience. There's nothing to laugh at. There's no stupid Jackass stunts to enjoy. Even the ones that you see in the trailer are just that, and they're not they just happen sort of randomly, and nothing is, it's just, I mean, I just expected some effort. Like, if you're gonna make a movie, you know, for your audience, and clearly, you know, Johnny Knoxville and the Jackass crew, they have a specific audience that will go and see their stuff. I mean, this is bottom of the barrel, easily the worst thing Johnny Knoxville has been in, and that, let's say, that is saying something.
So I was mulling this over in my head. I really kind of narrowed it down to, there are really three types of bad movies. You have movies like Suburbicon, where it's made by a talented person who clearly just went off the rails and was trying to say something that was really gross and had no idea how to tie that together. You have bad movies like The Book of Henry, where it's enjoyably awful at times. It's so campy and bad that you just can't help but marvel in its awfulness. And then you have movies like Action Point that don't even fucking try to be movies. This was an idea that Johnny Knoxville had, and I read that it's loosely based off of a real amusement park. Yeah, that, like, six people died at in real life, which, you know, obviously that's a comedy fucking goldmine right there. But this doesn't, and, you know, I will say that last week I watched Ivan Reitman's Meatballs on a whim. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night, and I was just enjoying that. And I understand that Action Point is kind of going for that same vein here, that summer nostalgia, and that's really about it. And maybe the fact that Johnny Knoxville is now 47 years old plays a lot into that. Maybe it's him almost trying to recapture some of that glory and know that it's still in. Obviously, when he was I watched Jackass 2 as recently as a few months ago and still laugh my ass off at it. I have no shame that those movies are hysterical. I will continue to watch them every once in a while, every few years, and just laugh my ass off at them. But like you said, all the stunts are actually in the trailer, and that was Johnny Knoxville's really, I hate to say it, but it was his only appeal, is that, and you know, I didn't see Bad Grandpa, I didn't really care to, it looked lazy, and I think action point is kind of the fait accompli of this, where he has really just run out of ideas. And, you know, obviously after the death of Ryan Dunn, it's hard to continue on the Jackass franchise to begin with. But for someone, you know, who grew up in high school watching Jackass, I had all the CKY videos and, you know, I watched like grown men poop on Bam Margera and think that that was funny for some reason. So obviously this kind of immature humor, as much as I will turn my nose up at it in my public life, in my private life, I am not immune to laughing at it. But this movie just doesn't even try. There's no plot to it. It's just like this rah-rah anti-establishment crap that really doesn't go anywhere. They want to build it around these set pieces, like, oh, look at this bear, he's drinking from a beer can, or and there's this really like weird moment where they're trying to capture animals for a petting zoo, and like they pick a raccoon up by its tail and they're harassing a porcupine, and someone rides an ostrich later on. I'm wondering if this, you know, no animals were harmed in the making of. I know that that's a bullshit line anyway, and animals get killed every day on movie sets, but this is just like really gross to see it played out on screen in that way. And it's not funny either. That's the biggest sin of it, is that none of this is funny. I didn't even crack a smile once. All these gags, like you said, most of the jokes are already in the trailer, and the jokes that weren't in the trailer were just because they were too crude to be on screen, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they were clever in any way. And, you know, the little girl who plays the daughter, or there's like this statistician named Rodney that's always walking around with a clipboard and trying to talk about ticket prices or something. He's basically Basil Exposition. That kid clearly has a little bit of talent, and it's a shame to see them waste away under, I hate to use the word tutelage, but under the visage of Johnny Knoxville and Chris Pontius. And Chris Pontius has like this really, it might have been funny 20 years ago, but now that he's pushing 50, it's a little uncomfortable to see him, you know, walking around half naked in front of a 16-year-old girl and just like having these really awkward like sexual come-ons to her. It's just uncomfortable and unpleasant. And again, I don't want to hammer home this point, but if you didn't guess from what we've said so far, it's not funny at all.
It's god awful. I mean, like I said, it barely qualifies as a film, like, and the only elements that would make it a film are the most cliched things imaginable. And I was reading some reviews because I wanted to get to the bottom of how these people gave it a positive review, and I saw someone mention the anarchic spirit of the film, and look, I could see where you could see the film is, you know, there's some element of that, but there's nothing to it. There's no reason to care about anything that happens. And look, if this was just a Jackass film with ridiculous stunts, I would have been fine. Who cares about the narrative? Go for it. When the trailer promises real stunts, we expect real stunts, not just the couple we see in the trailer and literally nothing else. I mean, if you think of this narrative of a Johnny Knoxville film is going to pull us through, you're sorely mistaken. And you mentioned the animals, you know, being harmed in this thing. First of all, I wasn't going to sit through the credits to see if they actually had that warning up there. But I want to talk about, this reminded me of the credit sequence, you know, a thing that, you know, Jackass films are known for, you know, showing different alternate angles or stuff like this. This credit sequence where they have the images is literally almost like replayed footage from the film. There's nothing else to it. And the stuff they show is not funny. It's just like random stuff. It's like, is this supposed to be funny? Like, you're just throwing random footage on the screen? Like, I don't even know what is happening here. Like, it was just baffling to me. And it's just the ultimate form of laziness. And I've seen Johnny Knoxville making, you know, the rounds, trying to advertise and stuff like this. And I'm like, man, you got to go back to the drawing board. I know it's hard to make another Jackass film, as you had mentioned, with Ryan Dunn and stuff like that. But honestly, if you want to have a career, you might have to. Because, I mean, narrative is not the way to go. And if you want to be a part of a film that actually I want to tell a story, Johnny, do not write it yourself. Go into someone else's film and be a part of it, because it's safe to say it's not working. But man, I mean, this film is just really, really abysmal. I couldn't believe, I was just sitting in the theater and I just couldn't believe what I was watching, because it was like not a laugh anywhere to be found, not an interesting stunt to just laugh out in a childish way. There is nothing to this movie, and sometimes that's the most depressing thing at all. Honestly, the more I think about it, it's not a contender for worst film of the year. It is the worst film of the year.
And of several years prior, probably. But, you know, you mentioned that, like, Johnny Knoxville clearly still wants to have a career and still have some kind of relevance. I understand that, but it's not something that I necessarily can relate to, because I, you know, using, so I was on a medical leave from work last year, and I just loved having that much freedom. And ever since I've gone back to work, I've done nothing but plot my way to retiring at 40 years old and figuring out somehow that I can do it. Honestly, if that means even doing one Jackass movie, getting my ass kicked, making $5 million, and then just riding off into the sunset to never be heard again, what is wrong with that? There's something to be said for peaking at the right time. And obviously they did when Johnny Knoxville was on the cover of Rolling Stone with the bullseye getting shot with the paint gun and the balls. There is a time limit on this kind of stuff. And I don't want to sound ageist, because I certainly think that slapstick and crude humor can work well past, you know, well into your geriatric years. But here it just is desperate and lazy, because it's trying to recapture something in a way that just seems cynical, and there's no sense of self-awareness to it. And I think that's the biggest problem, the biggest reason that the jokes really drag down is that, because there's just like this anticipation that it's going to garner laughs regardless, because maybe they are used to getting laughs on a lot of this material. And in the context of, I mean, it's certainly, there were some cringeworthy moments in the Jackass films, especially watching them as an adult, to the extent of, you know, political correctness and sincere lack thereof. I mean, one of the characters was named Wee Man, for God's sake. But there is a cap on this, and society has evolved past that. Not that I'm saying that these stunts still can't be funny, because like I said, I still watched it pretty recently and I still laughed. But I just think that it needs to evolve with the time. I don't even know if this is the right movie to dissect on this particular point. You know, forget I said anything. It's a piece of shit. Don't even fucking bother.
Well, I did want to just mention briefly, because I forgot to earlier, you mentioned, you know, that this is based on, you know, the history of a real life amusement park, which is known as Action Park, which is now the defunct amusement park set in New Jersey. And I know a bit about the history from it. I'm one of these YouTube obsessives, and I go down many, many rabbit holes. And amusement parks is one of my interests or whatever, so sometimes I look at the history of defunct, there's this great YouTube channel that I'll recommend now, Defunct Land, which I highly recommend, about defunct rides at all big major amusement parks. And there's a whole episode based on Action Park, and in the end of the episode they mentioned that Johnny Knoxville was adapting, you know, this for a film or whatever. And look, I wasn't expecting some grand magnum opus about amusement parks from Johnny Knoxville, certainly, but I expected some fun, and there is none to be had in this. So you'd be better served looking at the history of Action Park, because it's actually really interesting, and there's this whole family dynamic, and literally there were rides. Some of the rides in the film are actually legitimate, like the loop-to-loop water ride, which was actually a thing, and people, you can imagine, people got hurt on that shit. I just wish they, Johnny Knoxville, took a more interesting route and actually, you know, wanted to do something more with it, and you know, and you know, for now, you know, I have the recommendation. I already talked about recommending, you know, if you want to tell a story, go with another filmmaker, you know, Johnny Knoxville, you know, other than, you know, that's the best advice I can give you, other than try not to kill yourself doing something stupid, which I know is something you're prone to do. But with that in mind, I think it's safe to say we can turn our attention to our next episode when we'll be taking a look at Hereditary. All I can say is, if you haven't seen it yet, prepare yourself, because you're in for something certainly unique. And of course, Ocean's 8.
I'm going to put you on the spot before we end. Since we're seeing Ocean's 8, what's your favorite Gary Ross movie?
Gary Ross. Oh, man, it's tough. I got a tough choice here. For those of you who don't know Gary Ross, he directed the first Hunger Games movie. He directed Seabiscuit. But I think I'm going to go with my go-to Gary Ross movie from childhood. Pleasantville is where it's at. Although I can only imagine watching it now. There's probably some elements of that film that probably haven't aged the best. But I'm going to go with Pleasantville.
I guess Pleasantville for me too. I don't really have a strong opinion one way or another. But as always, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.